Okay, good evening, Chodesh Tov, Mishenichnas Adar Marvim B'Simcha, and Bemet, Mitzvah Hashem, it should be a month of Simcha and Basaras Tovas for all of us. We have 2 Mondays before Purim, and we began last year to take the first of those 2 Shiurim and take a look at Megillas Esther. This is after many years of having devotedly followed the incredible Perush of the Yosef Lekach, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, on the Megillah. We reluctantly prized ourselves away and began to look at other Meforshim, although some of his ideas are so tightly woven into the understanding, they may yet make appearances. But last year we saw Perek Aleph, and let us now pick up with Perek Beis of Megillas Esther. And as we'll see, one of the great benefits of studying the Megillah in this way is that there are so many details and nuances that it's easy for them to pass us by as we hear the Megillah all at once. And as we know from our own experience, many meaningful a thought has been ripped asunder by noise-making devices, so that the lessons are to be gleaned from a proper study. And we begin at the beginning of Perek Beis, which of course takes its cue from the events of Perek Aleph, the episode with Vashti, and thus the parak begins. After these things, Keshoch Hamas Hamelech Achashverosh, when Achashverosh's anger had abated, Zachar es Vashti ve'esa shirasasa, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, ve'esa shenigzar aleha. So this opening pasuk specifies 3 things, which makes it sound almost like a protracted and elongated thought, almost in slow motion. I mean, for us, as soon as you say Vashti, it brings to mind the entire episode at that time. But Achashverosh, it seems, thinks a little slower, and therefore he remembers Vashti, and then what she did, and then what was decreed against her. Why is the thought unfolded in that way? And it's especially interesting to consider this introductory pasuk in light of what happens next. He begins to get advice from his stewards and courtiers. They say he should look for a new wife. Who asked them? Where is that coming from? He's remembering Vashti. Where is the cue or the segue into advice for a new wife? Rabbi Meir Arama, who is a son of the better known Rabbi Yitzhak Arama, the author of Akedas Yitzchak, so Rabbeinu Meir, his son, has a pirush on the Megillah, and he explains that the way that this is the introduction to finding a new wife for Achashverosh is because this is the meaning of the 2 phrases. He remembers Vashti, and what about her? Number one, Eis Asher Asasa, that which she did, which led to her hasty exit. The Esa Shenigzar Aleha, and that which was decreed upon her, and what was decreed upon her. The decree itself has 2 parts, if we recall Memuchan's words from Perek Aleph. Number one, Vashti got cancelled. Ashelo Tova Vashti, she can't come to Achashverosh. The Pasuk doesn't specify that she was killed. The Gemara says she was killed. She's certainly out of the picture. But Memuchan says something else. Umalchusa Yiten HaMelech, and the queenship shall be given to a better woman, her fellow who is better than her. And that means that the full decree of Vashti isn't fulfilled just by Vashti being taken out of the picture, but by someone else coming into the picture. And this is something that Achashverosh brings to mind, and according to some Mefarshim, not just to mind, but he began to speak about it. And that's why his advisors hear him saying, well, where's my new queen going to come from? Where is the Ru'usa HaTova Mimena? That's also part of what was decreed against Vashti. She should be replaced. And that is why the stewards come in with their grand plan of this contest and competition, that he should see all the available and eligible girls. And that is described in Pasuk Beis. Vayomru Na'arei HaMelech Mesher Asav. So the young lads of the king, we would assume that Na'arim are young. They don't a Na'ar doesn't have to be young, but typically it is. Yivakshu LaMelech Na'aros B'Solos Tavos Mar'eh. They should seek out all the beautiful girls and as they lay out the details of this plan. And some Mefarshim ask a simple question. The king doesn't normally take advice from Ne'arim, from young people. We assume advising the king is a career and there are those who are more experienced. The shaila is, where did all the older advisors go? Why is he taking advice from the youth? Indeed, the Targum, and there is an extensive Targum on Megillas Esther, which gives us many, many details. So the Targum actually says that Achashverosh, he was so upset afterwards with what happened with Vashti, he killed all the advisors who were there, who went along with the idea of killing Vashti. Because why did they tell me to do that? And the question is, had they been replaced yet? We should note that the perek begins Achar Hadvarim Ha'ela. We know from Rashi that there's a difference between Achar and Acharei. Achar means immediately after or soon after. Acharei means a while after. Acharei is actually the plural of Achar. So Achar means after, and Acharei means afters, meaning a few afters, meaning therefore a number of things happened. So this is still Achar Advarim Ha'ele. It could be that the original group of advisors had yet to be replaced, and the only ones who were there are the junior advisors. Others, however, understand that Achashverosh had already replaced his senior advisors, but none of them were interested in advising him about this, for the simple reason that they saw what happened to the first ones. The moral of the story is, whatever you can, don't give advice to Achashverosh, because if it ever backfires, he'll be coming for you. And therefore, the older, more experienced advisors who had a bit more seichel, they made it their business to be occupied with other things. And it was left to the younger, more impetuous, who didn't really have any inhibitions, that perhaps didn't really have that much sense, and they wanted to try their hand at giving advice to Achashverosh. And so he took advice from the younger generation. There is an elaboration on this idea, and it is cited in the classic Perush, Manos Halevi. Manos Halevi on Megillas Esther was written by Reb Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, author of Lecha Dodi. And it's a 500-page commentary on Megillas Esther. It includes wonderful, wonderful things. And he says further, the reason why the older advisors did not want to give Eitzah to Achashverosh here, they didn't even want to be around Achashverosh. For the simple reason is that they know the importance of Yichus. If you would ask the older advisors, they would say, find someone from good stock. The problem is, the best stock is really with the advisors. They are the nobles of the country. And therefore, the older advisors who had daughters of marriageable age already, they were petrified that if any of them give an Eitzah to Achashverosh, and in their eyes what he should be looking for, he should be looking for Yuchus. The worst case scenario, disaster scenario, would be that he would turn to one of them and say, oh, your daughter would do fine, and then who knows what's going to happen to her. And therefore they made it their business to be elsewhere, or they called in sick, or they suddenly were disappeared. The only people that were left were those that didn't really have daughters of marriageable age. That's the younger generation. They had nothing to lose. And they give him this advice. And the truth is, the advice of the younger stewards isn't about Yichus at all. Perhaps because they were younger, they didn't appreciate what Yichus is. As far as they're concerned, if she looks nice, what else can there be to a perfect marriage? And they therefore just said that they should be looking for girls who are tovas mareh. And ironically, Achashverosh liked the idea. he liked the idea that he doesn't need to look for Yichus. It could be that Achashverosh had enough of Yichus just for the time being. The last Miyuchesis he was married to was Vashti, and she was a complete headache. And therefore, someone from humbler origins, it could be, would be more manageable. And if she looks nice, all the better. So Achashverosh goes for the idea, and they detail it in a couple of psukim. It's very elaborate, as we'll see. According to the simple reading of the psukim, this actually took a few years to come to fruition. If it's really a question of going throughout the kingdom, finding the eligible girls, bringing them in, processing them, preparing them, and so on, and then meeting them one at a time, it really takes a long time. So on the one hand, Achashverosh is anxious to get married, but the process that's presented to him is quite protracted. But so be it. And that brings us to Pasuk Hey, where we meet Mordechai, the first of our two tzaddikim of the Megillah. Mordechai and Esther, will meet them both. And Pasuk Hey, Ish Yehudi, this is the first of the psukim that are traditionally said out loud in public readings. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. There was a Yehudi in Shushan HaBira. We've noted in the past that when the Pasuk refers to Shushan HaBira, it might not be the same place as when it refers to Shushan, or Ha'ir Shushan, the city Shushan. This is already pointed out by the Ibn Ezra, and he is actually of the opinion that Shushan and Shushan HaBira are two distinct locations. They're not even in the same place. They're not far away from each other, but they really are two different places. A variation on that theme, we've cited many times from Reb Reuven Margolius, is that in the Sefer HaMikra Vamasora, is that Shushan HaBira was a city within a city. It was like the royal palace city, and it was surrounded by a wall, and that's Shushan HaBira, and it's located in the heart of the broader city, which is called Shushan. So Mordechai actually lives in this inner city, which is called Shushan HaBira. What else do we find out about him? He's Mordechai, he's Ben Yair, Ben Shim'i, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini. So the first point that we note in the Pasuk is that his lineage, as presented in the beginning and as presented at the end, are not the same. In the beginning of the Pasuk, he's called Ish Yehudi. Sounds like he's from the tribe of Yehuda. In the end, he's called Ish Yemini. Sounds like he's from Binyamin, which we know that he was. But then how does Ish Yemini go together with Ish Yehudi? And the Gemara itself discusses this question, and there are a couple of answers, but the straightforward answer in the Gemara is that his father was from Binyamin, and his mother was from Yehuda, and that's why his full lineage is given. Interestingly, he's first called Ish Yehudi after his mother, and then in the end, Ish Yehudi, which is where his father came from. So says the Gemara, we get the both branches of his background, Yehuda and Binyamin. Rashi, on the Megillah, on Megillas Esther, gives, again, a straightforward explanation that Yehudi is a very general name for anyone who was really part of our people at that time. Yehuda was the predominant, the majority of them were from Yehuda. Not all of them, some are from Binyamin, that may well be. But when you introduce someone first, they would always be called Yehudi. And subsequently, if they happened to come from not Yehuda, you would then specify that they were Ish Yemini. And the truth is that in our experience, that's exactly what we do. It's the equivalent of saying there was a Jew who came from Shevet Binyamin. And you might say, well, if he's a Jew and he's a Yehudi, he's from Yehuda, so then he's not from Binyamin. But it's a generic and inclusive term. I mean, the truth is that if you know someone who's a Kohen or who's a Levi, it's accurate to say that they're not Jewish, in the sense that if they're from Levi, they're not from Yehuda. But I think they might take it badly if you would tell them that they're not Jewish, because they are. They're super Jewish. They're not only are they Yehudim, they're Leviim, and even though those two things are different, but we understand that Yehudi is the more general term. And then specifically from within that, he was Ish Yemini. There is a fascinating medrash, just a third approach to Yehudi and Yemini. And the medrash says the reason why Mordechai, even though he was from the tribe of Binyamin, is initially introduced as Ish Yehudi, is because Yehuda and Binyamin have a bond. And Yehuda has great credit by Binyamin. How so? Because Yehuda was the one, all those centuries ago, who came forward when it seemed that Binyamin was going to be held by Yosef in Mitzrayim. They didn't know it was Yosef at the time. They think it's Tachnas Paneach, it's this Egyptian viceroy. And he says, you can all go home, I'll take Binyamin. But Yehuda had pledged to look after Binyamin's well-being. And he comes forward. Vayigash elav Yehuda, Parshas Vayigash. And he says, if you need a servant, take me and let him go. In the end, at that point, Yosef says, I'm Yosef. And interestingly, for us, we might think, so then nothing really came of it in the end. It's very nice that he was prepared to do that. But in the end, it wasn't necessary, and therefore it didn't really have any impact. But it did have impact. From that point onwards, Binyamin is indebted to Yehuda. They have gratitude towards Yehuda always. And it's interesting to note, as we mentioned just now, even as the kingdom of Israel split into two, the north and the south, most of the tribes went with the north, but who stays with Yehuda? Binyamin. Now the northern kingdom is Yeravam. That's how it starts. Yeravam is from Ephraim. He's from Yosef. Yosef and Binyamin are brothers from Rachel. There's only two of them. And Binyamin isn't that much more to the south any more than some of the other tribes that align themselves with Yosef in the north. Binyamin stays with Yehuda, because he has allegiance to Yehuda. That was a historic gesture on Yehuda's part. And the result was Mordechai is around at the time of the Megillah. Otherwise, he would have disappeared together with the 10, or what they might have been known as the 11 tribes at that time. And as the Medrash says, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Yehuda, Atama sarta nafshecha le'eve tachas bin Yamin. You offered yourself to be a servant, when ending all prospects for you personally, chayecha, by your life, hagoel shasid la'amod li'Yisrael, the Redeemer, the human agency of redemption that will stand for the Jewish people in the future, l'shimcha ani kosvil, I will call him after you, l'kach ne'emar ish Yehudi. It's amazing to see how the reverberations of that act find expression in the Psukim and in the events of the Megillah. So these are some of the classic explanations for Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. And then we have his more specific Yichus. Ish Yehudi Ayah B'Shushan HaBirah, he's Mordechai, Ben Yair, Ben Shim'i, Ben Kish, as we said, Ish Yemini. So we're given the names of three of his ancestors, Yair, Shim'i, and Kish. And we might think there isn't room to comment here. That's very simply his forebears. But there is room to comment, because we understand that the Kish in question here, third one up, is Kish, the father of Shaul. Shaul ben Kish. Shaul lived hundreds of years before Mordechai, over 400 years, close to 500. So there was only three generations between Shaul's father and Mordechai. There were undoubtedly many more, which means most of them have not been mentioned, which means those that are mentioned for a specific reason beyond the matter of lineage. And that is the background to the drasha of the Gemara. This is in Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Beis, Amud Beis. As we know, the first parak of Megillah contains within it effectively a commentary on Megillas Esther. And the Gemara explains that all of these three names, in addition to the genealogy of Mordechai, are attributes of Mordechai, and they all relate to the same concept. Tefillah, prayer. He's called Ben Yair. Yair means illumination. The Gemara explains She'heir einehem shel Yisrael b'tfiloso. He illuminated the eyes of the Jewish people with his tefillah. He showed them the way to daven for their salvation. Shim'i, from the word lishmoa, to hear. Sheshama keil tefiloso. Hashem heard his tefillah. And kish. What does kish mean? What is lahakish? Is to bang or to knock? Shehikish al shari rachamim v'niftuchu lo. He banged on the gates of mercy and they were opened for them. We see that from the very initial introduction, Mordechai is introduced as someone who invested in tefillah. And indeed, that is what that's what's being highlighted here. And the reason why that's so noteworthy is because as we read the rest of the Megillah, it's all about his hishtadlus and his advice to Esther and his guidance and so on, and his confrontation with Haman. All of that, yes. But the Ruach HaChaya, the current that's running through all of that, is his tefillahs on behalf of the Jewish people. And here we see the centrality of the concept of prayer within the story of Megillas Esther. Indeed, according to the Rambam, it is for this reason the entire festival of Purim exists. The Rambam in the beginning of Mishneh Torah lists all of the 613 mitzvahs. This is aside from his separate work, Sefer HaMitzvahs, which is something else entirely, written in Arabic at a different time, where he discusses the mitzvahs. But his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, he lists the mitzvahs. And when he gets to the very end, he says that that's it. 613. There's no adding, there's no subtracting. But at the very end, he comes to talk about, and what about Megillah? Lo amru, Shakadosh Baruch Hu tziva likros haMegillah ba'onasa. No one ever said that Hashem said, told us to read the Megillah. I mean, it can't be. Megillah is happening after the time of Sinai, and there is no revelation for mitzvahs of the Torah after Sinai. But still we have Purim. Ela kach anu omrim. Rather we say as follows. Shanavim im Bezdin, the Nevi'im together with the Bezdin, of course only Bezdin can really formulate something halachically, tiknu v'tzivu likros haMegillah ba'onasa. They instituted to read the Megillah, Kedela Haske Shivachov Shalakadish Baruchu, to recall the praises of Hashem, Utashuos Shasalanu, and the salvations that he wrought for us, Vayakarv Leshav Einu, and was close to our prayers, was close to our cries, Kedela Varucho, Ulahalalo, to bless and praise Hashem, and then says Rambam, Ukedela Hodiela Doros Haboy, to teach all future generations to verify that which the Torah has assured us. And he quotes a pasuk from Vayeshanan, Ki mi goy gadol asher lo elokim kervim elav, kashem elokeinu b'chol kareinu elav. There is no nation that Hashem is close to them when they call to him, as Hashem is close to us when we call to him. That is what the entire reading of the Megillah halachically, says Rambam, is there to emphasize. It's to elucidate that pasuk in the Torah. So effectively, the concept is in the Torah already, that Hashem hears the prayers of the Jewish people. This received a graphic and historic expression in the story of Megillah, and that's how Purim becomes a chag. It's a festival of the potency of prayer. And that's important, not only for their times, as the Rambam says, lehodia ledoros haboyim, to tell future generations, with all the other ways that we try and deal with the problems that we have, to understand that just like with Mordechai, did what needed to be done, but in within all of that are his prayers that make all of that investment effective, so too for us. So that's certainly a lesson, an annual lesson for the ages to reflect on during Purim. So this is Mordechai. And then we find out where he's from. Asher haglam Yerushalayim, im agolo asher haglosa, im yechonya melech Yehuda, pasuk vav, asher hagla nevucha netzar melech Bavel. So he was exiled at the time of Nebuchadnezzar already, from Yerushalayim. We know traditionally this verse is read in the Eicha tune. We need to recall, as long as the Jewish people are in exile, they need to remember that. To be in exile is a lamentable thing. And indeed, as we know, even after the success of the Purim story, we were still in exile. So the success of the Purim story is that we were not annihilated, which of course is the beginning of everything. The eternity of the Jewish people, Netzach Yisrael, 100%. But never to forget that the full realization of our destiny is not to stay in Golos. Indeed, Yerushalayim, for many, it is for this reason that Yerushalayim specifically has outsized significance within the festival of Purim. There's a special day for cities that were ruled from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, not from the time of Achashverosh. And the reason why, says the Yerushalmi, appropriately, is Mishum Kvodo Shel Yerushalayim. Had the time stamping for a city with a wall been the days of Achashverosh, Yerushalayim was in ruins at that time. There was no wall. The wall had been destroyed. Yerushalayim would be reading together with everyone on the 14th, and it wouldn't have that special status. In respect to that, in deference to that, the time was pulled back to Yeshua ben Nun. And now go find another city that you know for sure was walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. Yerushalayim for sure. Shushan is where the story happens. So of course it will be in Shushan. And all of this is in order that we don't forget Yerushalayim within the story of Purim. That ultimately is where we need to be headed back to. And indeed, Mefarshim point out the very word Yerushalayim in this pasuk is written differently than it is in most other places in Tanakh. It's interesting, Yerushalayim appears many places in Tanakh, and it's always without a yud at the end. It's yud resh vav, shin lamed mem, perhaps, without a yud at the end. We pronounce it as if there's a yud. Everyone writes it nowadays with a yud. But in the Tanakh, it's without a yud. Initially, it was called shalem, and maybe that's why. But in our pasuk, it's written male, with a yud, to emphasize the duality of Yerushalayim. Why is it in the dual form, like Raglaim and Yadayim? Are there two Jerusalems? There are Yerushalayim Shalmata and Yerushalayim Shalmala. And even if Yerushalayim Shalmata is in ruins, Yerushalayim Shalmala doesn't go anywhere else. The city retains its special status, and that's emphasized here as the word is written in a way that in no uncertain terms reflects the dual nature, both above and below, of Yerushalayim. So moving to Pasuk Zion, we then meet the second hero, really, or heroine, Tzadekus, and that is, well, let's see who she is. Pasuk Zion to read, Vayihi Omein, he was a guardian for Es Hadasa, he Esther Bastodo, ki ein la avaim. So he took Hadasa, who was Esther, into his care. She was orphaned at a very young age, at Chazal say at birth, and he took her in. So who is she? She's called Hadassah, who is Esther. And still then we ask, who is she? Is she Hadassah or is she Esther? Which is her primary name and which was the name that was perhaps given to her? And here there are two approaches within the Gemara. The one approach is that her name is really Hadassah. The name given to her at birth or when she was young was Hadassah. That's her name. When the Megillah says Hadassah, who is Esther, which means for purposes of the Megillah, she will be called Esther. And why is she called Esther? Why is that her Megillah name? Says the Gemara, two reasons. Number one, because Histira Devareha. Esther is hidden. She hid her identity. That's very significant in the story. And therefore she becomes known. Her Megillah name is the hidden one, Esther. Interestingly, the Gemara gives a second perush there on the name Esther, and that is from the word istahar. What does istahar mean? Istahar, says Rashi, is Persian for the moon. And what then does it mean? She was a very beautiful girl, beautiful woman. Yofa kalavana, as we say in Shir HaShirim. Beautiful, she had the beauty of the moon. And therefore, she becomes known as Esther after istahar, Yofa kalavana. So these are two of the explanations as to if her birth name was Hadassah, why is her Megillah name Esther? There is another approach, which sees the converse, namely that her birth name was actually Esther. And it's the Megillah that calls her Hadassah, albeit actually here just this one time. And why is she called? Why would her Megillah name be Hadassah? Because, says the Gemara, she's like a Hadass, she's like a myrtle. Hadass is something that is associated with tzaddikim. Tzaddikim are called hadassim, especially when they maintain their fragrance wherever they are. And Esther was in a very difficult situation, but still she maintained her tzidkus like a hadass, and that's why the Megillah calls her Hadassah. There is another explanation of this Megillah name Hadassah, and it actually relates to another question. The pasuk says that Esther was tovas mar'eh. That's actually here still in pasuk Zion. Vanara, in fact, says yefas toar v'tovas mar'eh. And that's, again, there's nuances here. Normally we hear, for example, Yosef is called yefei toar v'yefei mar'eh, or Rachel yefas toar v'yefas mar'eh. Here she's called yefas toar v'tovas mar'eh. And the Mepharshim discuss the nuances, yefas mar'eh, tovas mar'eh. Either way, it sounds like she was a very beautiful girl. And yet the Gemara says, one opinion of the Gemara says, Esther Yirak Rokas Haisa, she kind of had like a greenish pull about her. Except, Chud Shel Chesed Nimshach Aleha, but Hashem gave her favor in people's eyes, which overlooked the fact that she didn't really look so. She was green like a hadas. Sometimes Yarok in the words of Chazal means yellow. If they want to say green, they'll say Yarok Kakarti, leek green. But here, if she's like called Hadass over her appearance, so it sounds like she wasn't naturally so good looking, but she had a certain charm with people. So says the Gemara. But the Vilna Gaon famously adds, I mean, the Pasuk does say that she's Tovas Mareh. I mean, how can one say otherwise? And that's why he understands that this opinion, which says that she looked greenish a little bit, off, not her normal color, and it was really charm that got her through, is because of everything that she went through, being taken from Mordechai and be going through this whole process and potentially having to marry Ahasuerus. That's what turned her Hadass-like. And she lost a lot of her good looks, and it was only Chud Shel Chesed that really carried the day. Either way, but that's one opinion in the Gemara. The others take the Pasuk Kipshuto, the Tovas Mareh, means Tovas Mareh. Okay. And Mordechai took her in. The Pasuk says that Mordechai took her Labas as a daughter. There is a well-known opinion in the Gemara that Labas is Labayis, that they were actually married. The Pashtos of the Pasuk is that she was like his daughter. Okay. And now Esther is taken. Pasuk Ches. Vayihi. Bi shama dvar ha-melech vidaso. When the king's word and law become known. And everyone is collected there to Hegai. Vatilakach Esther al Beis Hamelech al Yad Hegai Shomer Hanashim. She is also taken. Dvar Hamelech Vidaso, the king's word and the king's law. Why are there two elements here? Presumably, it's the idea that all the girls should be collected. So Mepharshim explain that the word Dvar HaMelech is just the word should be let out that the girls should come. Most of them came willingly. Nothing needed to be enforced. The Das, the legal aspect, is that even those that don't want to come but are deemed eligible have to come anyway. For the most part, we didn't need to enforce the law. They jump at the chance to possibly be the next queen. But for someone like Esther, she's not interested. It was only the law that she couldn't escape. And that's why the pasuk says, Vatilakach Esther. She was taken. She doesn't want to go, but she has no choice. And interestingly, again, to see the details in the pasuk, with regards to the other girls, in pasuk Ches, it says, Uvikavetz Naros Abos El Shushan Abira El Yad Hegai. All the other girls were collected to Hegai. Where is Esther taken? Vatilakach Esther. El Beis HaMelech, El Yad Hegai. She's taken to the king's palace, to Hegai. The king's palace wasn't mentioned with reference to any of the other girls. Why is it, they just went straight to Hegai, and that's all we hear about them. Why is Beis HaMelech mentioned with reference to Esther? And some say that we can already see that she stood out from everyone else, which means as much as she's going to go through the processing of everyone else with the 6 months of the oil and so on and so forth. But before she was given over to Haggai, she was actually taken for a meeting, an initial meeting with Ahasuerus, El Beis HaMelech. And as if to say, this is one to watch. And then she was given over to Haggai. But first she visits Beis HaMelech. That's very interesting. And in fact, that if that is the case, it might affect the way we read Pasuk Tes. Because Pasuk Tes says, Vatitav ha-nara be'einav, the girl was good in his eyes. Vatisachese lefanav, and she drew out kindness from him. Again, here the verse, the Pasuk says, Vatisachese. Elsewhere it will say, Vatisachein vachesed. And elsewhere it will say, Nosachein. What does it mean to draw out chain? What does it mean to draw out chesed? But be that as it may, he starts expediting her portions, which seemingly is food. Interestingly, the very first monos in the Megillah are not mishloach monos. They're the portions that are given to Esther at this time. And the seven girls that are fit for her, mibeis hamelech. Who is being referred to in Pasuk Tes? She found favor in his eyes. He expedited. He gave her. Who is he? Well, we would assume that it's Haggai, because that's where she is. But Yesh Omrim, there are some who say, and this is cited again in Manos HaLevi, it's Ahasuerus. When she went to Beis HaMelech, as described in Pasuk Ches, he was already so taken with her, he doesn't want to have to wait for her to get to the back of the line. And that could be another X amount of months or more. And therefore, he hurries her along. She still needs to go through all of that processing, etc. But it's amazing to consider that the pronoun of he, the subject is actually Ahasuerus who's doing all of this. Even though, for most Mefarshim, it's Haggai who is doing this, all of these things in Pasuk Tes. Okay. Lohigida Esther, Pasuk Yud. Lohigida Esther Sama Vesmolarato. She doesn't say where she's from. Ki Mordechai Tziva Aleha Asher Lo Tagid. Because Mordechai told her not to. Which is interesting. Because whatever the reason that she shouldn't tell where she's from, that wasn't the reason that she didn't tell. The reason she didn't say anything is because Mordechai told her not to. That's all that Esther needed to hear. What's the reason? As far as Esther is concerned, Mordechai has his reasons. We may then ask, well, what are Mordechai's reasons? Why would Mordechai tell her not to tell? And here the Alshech HaKadosh already says that Mordechai sees there's such an unusual turn of events here. It's with Esther was living in his house, and now she's next in line to the queen. It's very clear. And of course, Mordechai, Bal Ruach HaKodesh, he might not know exactly what's going to happen, but it's clear that something will happen, and therefore now is not the time for people to know that she is Jewish. It could be that if people knew she was Jewish, she would be disqualified straight away. And therefore, he tells her to keep quiet. Mordechai tries to keep tabs on her. Pasuk Yud Aleph of V'chol Yom V'yom. Mordechai Mishalech Lifnei Chatzar Beis Hanashim. Ladasa Shalom Esther, Uma Yaseba. Every day, Mishalech is an interesting word. It's like he takes himself for a walk because he's Mordechai. He's the biggest rabbi in Shushan. It's strange for him to approach the Beis Hanashim, which is effectively a harem, directly. And also, he can't inquire about Esther because if people know there that he's inquiring about her, why would that be? No one is more Jewish than Mordechai, visibly. And therefore, he needs to mishalech. He just walks around. He's looking to overhear things, snippets or conversations, etc., tidbits, to see what is happening with Esther. Not only to see how she's faring, but is she okay? Is she in trouble? Is she in danger? And then the pasuk, for the next three or four psukim, give us details as to how this whole enterprise would go. It was a 12-month process. and 6 months in the oils and 6 months in the cosmetics, and the girls would meet one at a time, and she would in the evening she would come to Achashverosh, in the morning she would go back to this other person, Shashgaz, and that was the last you'd hear of her, unless the king called for her. And then when Esther comes in Pasuk Tesvav Uvagia Toras Debras Avichail, Dod Mordechai, so before actually we even get to Esther, it's very interesting that the pasuk has given us such detail as to what would happen with these other girls. The Vilna Gaon famously states, and as we know, the shita of the Gaon is that the Tami HaMikra often function not only how to read the words, but also as a form of commentary. If you have a look in pasuk Yud Beis on the how it describes the other girls, Uvagia Tor Nara Venara. The word, the tamim on the two words Nara v'Nara are the two crescents facing each other, known as Kadma v'Asla. And Kadma v'Asla means to go forward first, because that's the matzav with all of the other girls. Each one wants to be Kadma v'Asla. they want to go first to better their chances. Contrast that with Esther. Uvahagia tor Esther b'Savichaya, we know it from how we read it. The first three ta'amim are called munach, and munach is left behind. She doesn't want to be first. She doesn't even want to be last. She doesn't want to be anything. But she's not pushing herself to the front, because it's only with great reluctance that she goes to Pyro. Achashverosh, pardon me. Everyone else, a little early for that, okay. Everyone else is Kadma v'Asla, and Esther is munach, munach, munach. So says the Vilna Gaon. But when it comes her turn, finally it's unavoidable, and her turn has come. Uvagia Toras Debras Avichail Dod Mordechai, Asher Lakach Lo Levas Lavo LaMelech. She doesn't ask for anything. Lo Bikshe Davar Ki Im Asher Yomar Hegai Sus HaMelech Shem HaNashim. Only what Hegai says. Nothing special. Nothing extra. Okay. Very interesting. This is not the first time that we've discussed Esther. We've been with her for a few psukim, and she was introduced already about 10 psukim back, in Pasuk Zion. We never heard her father's name when she was originally introduced. Only now. Initially, she was just introduced as Mordechai's cousin. It's only later, 10 psukim later, that we discover her father's name was Avichail. Why is that element introduced at this juncture? And Manos HaLevi, Rav Alkabitz, explains that this is the real test of Esther, meaning is she going to do the right thing and conduct herself appropriately under the circumstances, not to try and ingratiate herself with Achashverosh too much and so on. In order to do the right thing and act correctly as a tzaddikus, she needs to draw on all of her kochos, including her lineage, her roots from her father Avichail, and also her association with Mordechai. They are what carried her through to make sure that she doesn't succumb to the, perhaps what's quite tempting, to basically make herself look as good for Achashverosh as she can, because it's good to be the queen. But for tzaddikus, it's not good to be the queen. And moreover, as Meforshim point out, this is further accentuated when we recall what happens if you don't become queen. In other words, that's why the psukim describe what happens to all of the girls that don't become queen. As if to say, if we would think that whoever wins becomes the queen, and whoever loses gets sent home with a consolation prize, so then it's clearly in her interest to fail so that she can go home. But there is no going home. If you fail, you go back to Shashgaz. So the two options are, it's either queen or concubine for life. Which means that there's nothing waiting for her if she loses, except just a life there with the Shashgaz and all the other girls. That's hardly appealing. Maybe it's more appealing to become the queen. B'chozot, relative to that, says Esther, not for me. Not for Bas Avichail. Not for a cousin of Mordechai. She's not asking for anything special. And if it doesn't work out, but that's better, regardless of the nil prospects that are waiting for her afterwards. However, it does work out, as the pasuk says, "Vati Esther no seischein." So again, Earlier we had Nasa Chen, Nasa Chesed. Now it's Chen. We also have Chen Vachesed sometimes. Pasuk Tet Zayin. Vatilakach Esther Lamelech Achashverosh El Beis Malchuso. So she is taken to Achashverosh. Again, as far as some Mefarshim are concerned, for the second time. But it's been a year and she's gone through all of that process. Bachodesh Asiri Uchodesh Teves. In the 10th month, which is the month of Teves. This is a recurring thing that happens in the Megillah. The months are given to us by name and also by number. And the reason why, says Ramban in Parshas Bo, is because initially the names were only numbered. The mitzvah is to count the names by numbers from Chodesh Nisan, just like you should count the days by numbers from Shabbos. But as the end of Golos Bavel, we adopted, for various reasons, as a Zecher, for the Golos, etc., or hopefully for the Geula, from their Persian names or Babylonian names. So this was the time of transition, which means literally when the Megillah is being written, that's when the, what used to be the 10th month is becoming known as the month of Teves. And that's why they'll always be referred to by both number and name, Chodesh Asiri or Chodesh Teves. And when did this happen? Says the end of Pasuk Tet Zayin. Bishnas Sheva Lemalchuso. In the 7th year of his reign. If we assume, as the Medrash does, that the timing, 7 years, goes back to the same timing of the 3 years of his party, if we assume they start at the same point, not all Mefarshim do, but it's the simple reading, one could say, then it turns out that this happened 4 years after the feast with Vashti. And don't forget, Achashverosh recovered from Vashti, he rebounded from her relatively quickly, achar hadvarim ha'ela. Which means from the inception of this idea until Esther, and Esther was expedited forward to Achashverosh, it was still 4 years. That's what seems to be the case. Well, apparently, as far as Achashverosh is concerned, it was worth the wait. And in Pasuk Yud Zayin, it says, Vayehav ha-melech es Esther mikol anoshim, v'tizachet v'ohir, chen v'cheset lefana mikol abesulos. He just thinks she's amazing. Vayosem keser malchus berosha vaymlichet tachas Vashti. That seems to be a very straightforward, practical detail. I mean, if she's a queen, she needs a crown. Why is it significant? Say the Mefarshim, the Alshech HaKadosh says this. It's a fascinating insight. Any coronation, for what it's worth, the ones that we've seen, who puts the crown on the monarch's head? It will be, it's a whole process. And again, it's stewards and it, the king might be there, but there's a procedure, there's protocol, there's the whole ceremony. It says the Alshech, Achashverosh basically ignored the whole thing. What was going to be a whole coronation and everyone would be there and then the servants would advance at a regal pace. Achashverosh basically took the crown and put it on her head, obviating any type of ceremony. What does that express? Says the Alshech, Ahava mekakeles Ashura. Love basically breaks all the rules, and Amura omnia vinkit, and there he goes. So here is Achashverosh putting the crown on Esther's head, and before anyone knows what's happened, the coronation has already taken place, and she's the queen. For the next psukim, Achashverosh basically tries to get Esther to reveal who, what her origins are, what her background is. Pasuk Yudches, Vayas Hamelech Mishte Gadol Lechol Sarav Havadav, Eis Mishte Esther. He makes a feast for Esther. So on the simple level, it's a celebratory feast, but it's more than that. He wants people to see her, and he wants her to get her talking. Maybe something will slip as to where she's from. Hard to be the center of attention and not say something about yourself. But apparently it doesn't work. So then he tries something else. He introduces tax concessions. What is Achashverosh thinking? That perhaps if he's doing that, then she may arbiter on behalf of her people. Achashverosh thinks that this might be the way to get her to reveal her. She says, maybe puts in a good word for a certain group. That could be a tip-off as to where she's from. So here is Achashverosh, ever the romantic, the way to a girl's heart is through tax rebates and such like. But it didn't work. And then Vayitein Maseski Ad HaMelech, he starts giving out gifts. Maybe she'll ask someone for special consideration. Nothing doing. And then the pressure mounts a little bit because in Pasuk Yotes, Uvi Kavetz Besulo Shenis, the girls are gathered again. And the implicit idea is maybe you're going to be replaced. We can redo the competition. And still, Esther doesn't waver on this. And it's significant, as Pasuk Kaf says, Ein Esther Magedes Melal Tevesama. She doesn't say what is her background, what's her origins. Kashet Tziva Alea Mordechai. Mordechai told her not to say. There is a Perush of the Rambam that is cited on Megillas Esther, and he notes, no one in the royal palace knew where Esther was from. The people knew. In other words, the Jewish people knew, and no one came forward. And that is an outstanding praise of the Jewish people. One may have thought that some opportunist might try and better their circumstances by providing the information. It's not happening. And that's a great merit. It is true, on the one hand, the Jewish people are criticized at that time or characterized as being mefuzer or meforad. There's machlokas between them. And that's a terrible thing. Machlokas between Jews. Terrible thing. But everyone knew to draw the line between having machlokas among themselves and giving someone like Achashverosh information that he didn't need to have. It should also be appreciated here. And this brings us to the final episode in Perek Beis, which is Bigtan and Teresh. Bayamim ahem pasuk kaf aleph, in those days when Mordechai yoshev b'shar ha-melech, Mordechai is sitting by the royal gate. Katzaf Bigtan and Teresh shnei sarisei ha-melech misham yasaf. You have these two stewards, Bigtan and Teresh. Bayavakshu l'shloach yad b'melech Achashverosh, and they wanted to kill Achashverosh. Who are Bigtan and Teresh? They're called Shomrei Hasaf. What is the meaning of Shomrei Hasaf? So there are two opinions that are given, cited, I believe, by the Ibn Ezra. Asaf might be a doorway, threshold of a doorway, saf, in which case they were gatekeepers. But saf can also mean kelim, vessels. In other words, Shomrei Hasaf, they were in charge of the kelim. They were cupbearers, which is a prestigious position, and certainly puts them in a strategic position should they decide to poison Achashverosh. I mean, they're the one that serves him his drinks. Interestingly, this word saf is also in the Chumash, and these two interpretations are given in the Chumash there as well. The very first Korban Pesach in Parshas Bo, we're told to take the dam of the Pesach with the hyssop, the agudas ezov, and dip it utvaltem badam asher basaf, to dip it in the blood which is in the saf. Where is the saf? Where is that blood? And here too, the Mechilta cites two explanations. One is that the blood was on the threshold of the door. Saf means threshold, but others say no, it had been collected in a vessel. And saf means kelim. So that shaila moves from Parshas Bo, also can be seen in Megillas Esther here. Why did Bigtan and Teresh want to kill Achashverosh? What did he ever do to them? So the Medrash says that the answer is in the beginning of the pasuk. Bayamim ahem uMordechai yoshev b'shar ha-melech. So this is interesting. How does Mordechai come to be sit by the king's gate? That seems to be a relatively new development. The Medrash says it was at the suggestion of Esther, which is interesting because she doesn't. There's no way that she wants Achashverosh to know that she's connected to Mordechai. However, the Medrash says that she says to Achashverosh, you know, the successful kings in the past have always had a wise Jew in the court. It's a good thing to have. I think I know someone if you're interested. And that was the promotion of Mordechai to be Yoshev b'shar ha-melech. This put out Bigtan and Teresh somewhat because they were the significant courtiers prior to that time. And now Mordechai is there and they've been pushed to the side a little bit and they're upset. They're upset at Achashverosh. And moreover, they want everyone to know if you push good old Bigtan and Teresh to the side, so you might be endangering yourself. So maybe the next monarch will think twice before doing that. Even so, it seems to be a very extreme and excessive plot on their behalf. After all, to consider, they stand to gain very little. They stand to lose a lot if they're found out, and to gain very little. They're not going to take over. The best they can hope for is to be put back in charge of the gate. Is the risk worth the reward? It doesn't seem to be. And indeed, the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu stirred them up in the same way that with Yosef, Hashem caused Paro to be angry over his servants for purposes of Yosef, threw them in jail. In our story, he causes the servants to be angry at Ahasuerus beyond what we would have expected. And that's alluded to by the fact that the Ketzef here, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Bayomim Mahem, Mordechai Yosef B'Shar HaMelech, Kotzaf B'Ktam V'Teresh. Kotzaf is in the singular, even though there's two of them, because there's actually one behind both of them who's really goading them and bringing them to the boil. And they try and kill Ahasuerus, but the matter is found out. The Gemara famously says they were speaking in some foreign dialect, but Mordechai knows that dialect, and he tells Esther, and Esther tells the king. And now the shaila is, why would Mordechai tell Esther to tell the king? Consider the alternative. The alternative is that Bigtan and Teresh succeed. So the bad news for Ahasuerus is that he'll be killed. The good news is that Esther at that point can go free. So seemingly a better outcome would be not to say anything, not to intervene. But Mordechai does, and Esther tells Ahasuerus. So once again, the Manos Halevi developing thing we saw before, Mordechai knows, as difficult and painful as it is, Esther is there for a reason, and she needs to be there with Ahasuerus. And ironically, Esther will end up saving Ahasuerus' life to keep him in play for when the time comes. No one knows exactly what that time will be, but she's there for historic purposes, and Ahasuerus cannot be allowed to exit the picture just yet. So says Manos Halevi. I wonder whether one may suggest, I haven't seen this in any of the Mefarshim, that perhaps the reason why Mordechai told Esther that she's got to alert Ahasuerus is because if she didn't, Esther would be in danger. Why would Esther be in danger? As we've said, there is no reasonable explanation as to why Bigtan and Teresh would want to kill Ahasuerus themselves. Small people are normally put up to things by big people. No one has any idea as to why Bigtan and Teresh would want to kill Ahasuerus, or anyone would. But the most recent person to enter the picture is someone who no one knows anything about. She's kept her origins a secret. She's kept her identity a secret. She's a mysterious person. When mysterious people enter the picture, and then a few days later, the king dies, so then they are the first in line of suspicion. Had the plot been discovered by some other means, or even had it not been discovered, but there'd been backlash afterwards, Esther would be suspect number one. And therefore it is to protect Esther that she needs to tell Ahasuerus that the plot cannot go through, and he needs to know about it, and that I perhaps may be another reason why Mordechai feels that Esther needs to tell Ahasuerus. In the end, the plot is uncovered. Esther tells Ahasuerus in the name of Mordechai. We have the famous concept of Omer Dover B'Shem Omro, to say something in the name of the person that told you, which means, as Mefarshim point out, Mordechai didn't tell her to tell Ahasuerus in his name. Because if she did, that's not called Dover B'Shem Omro. That's called following instructions. It's Dover B'Shem Omro that she wasn't told to say it in Mordechai's name, but she felt it was the right thing to do because the idea came from Mordechai, and that's Meviv Ge'ula La'ola. The final pasuk, Vayivukash Hadavai V'Yimatze, the matter was investigated, and it was found out, by Telush Ne'emaleitz, and the two were hanged, all thanks to Mordechai. Vayikasei B'Sefer Divrei Hayamim Lifnei HaMelech. And it was put in the chronicles before the king. What is the significance of those final two words before the king? Say the Mefarshim, Ahasuerus knew that Mordechai is a Jew and people will have issues with someone like Mordechai. And he knew that if he assigns recording this episode to the history recorders, but he doesn't supervise it personally, it's not done in front of him, there may be a very different story that's written in the history books, because the good person here was a Jew. And therefore, Ahasuerus says, write it down, and it should be Lifnei HaMelech. That's an interesting idea to see in history. Rishoyim come in many shapes and sizes. Some of them try and kill Jews. Some of them record history. Some of them present the news. There's many different versions of what a Russia can do to hurt the cause of the Jewish people, says Ahasuerus. I'd like to see exactly what they've written here so that it should be faithful to what was said. So these are some of the classic comments from a range of Meforshim on Perek Beis Megillas Esther. Again, as we to end the way we began, the details and the nuances of the psukim, so many things that it's so easy to hear the Megillah year in and year out, and we do a mitzvah when we hear the Megillah, of course. The main thing is Pesumei Nisa, but the more we pay attention to these finer points, the richer the picture that emerges, and the greater our appreciation, deeper, of the miracle of Purim. So that brings us to the end of Perek Beis. Perek Gimel Mirtz Hashem will pick up again next year. Feel free to consult the Meforshim if you can't bear the wait. And next week in Mirtz Hashem, we will discuss matters relating to Purim itself. All the very best. La'yehuda ma'isa'ur b'simcha b'sasam v'ikar. Kein t'yadonu shabbat sirus toros b'karav. All the best.